You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Plato, and for the rest of the hour, we have a lot to fit in fact, the entire universe, actually. When Sir Roger Penrose sat down to write a book about all things physics, he had no idea it would take 8 years, over 1,000 pages, and a lot of math. The Road to Reality, A Complete Guide to the Laws of the Universe, is Penrose's new book. It's a tour of physics from the Big Bang to black holes, from simple arithmetic to intense calculus and all kinds of mathematics in there. Dr. Penrose is Emeritus Rouse Ball Professor of Mathematics at Oxford, and he joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, welcome.
Did you realize what an undertaking this was?
Not really. No, it grew, really.
is there a main theme for the book?
I think as far as the theme is concerned, really, it's the interrelation between mathematics and physics, how one drives the other, basically. Mm-hmm. But it's trying to find out what we know about the laws that govern the world and what we don't know about the laws that govern the world and what people think about those laws and what may or may not be true. So these kinds of issues.
Now, as a layperson, you know, I remember when we, back 25 or so years ago, when I was... We thought the laws were going to get simpler, and you know, then we had this particle zoo, and things got worse. And it seems like things are getting even. The more we know, the more we don't know. You know, they got this dark energy; we don't know what it is. We've got these problems from quantum mechanics. We've got combining all the theories of the universe. Is it getting simpler? Or is it getting more difficult?
Well, I don't see much indication of it getting terribly simple just yet. I think one likes to think that, you know, eventually there will be some simple principle that governs everything, but mm-hmm. we're certainly a long way from that now.
And you write about that. You say that you don't think that even quantum mechanics is, you know, even though it's been proven very successful, that there's something else behind it there.
Well, I guess I have a lot of things in the book which I say which are not totally the conventional view on things. Mm-hmm. And one of them is, in fact, the limitations of quantum mechanics. I mean, quantum mechanics is, as you say, extremely well confirmed, and it's a beautiful theory in many respects, and it certainly agrees with all observations that have been made so far. The only trouble with it doesn't really make sense. And I think a theory ought to make sense.
details. What do you mean it doesn't make sense? I mean, I know there's a famous quote, you know, Feynman quote where he said, you know, anybody who tells you they understand why this works is lying, but it does work.
Yeah, well, it's only, it works at one level. The problem is when you try to apply the rules of quantum mechanics for a large object. I mean, Schrödinger pointed this out famously when he referred to the thing that's called Schrödinger's cat. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be hard, according to the rules of his own equation, that is, to make a state in which the cat was alive and dead at the same time, and he points this out. And this, he says, is ridiculous. So he says, don't believe my equation at that level. Something else has got to happen. Mm-hmm. So this is, it's the view that most people in quantum mechanics take is that somehow we've got to come to terms with this, and if we really understood the interpretation properly, we'd see that was okay. But my view is really a bit different from that. I say that something really is going to be different in the theory at a level a long way beyond anything that's been tested yet, but it would be a level below that of a cat, a good deal below that.
So where would it fall apart? At what level? Give us a little bit of
well,
insight.
Well, I can give you some insight because actually some colleagues of mine in Santa Barbara are involved in working towards an experiment which would test the ideas that I'm putting mm-hmm. forward here. And these involve putting a little tiny mirror, which is about the tenth of the thickness of a human hair. It's a little cube, which is about a tenth of the thickness of human hair in size. You really need a microscope, a lens, say, to look at it properly. And to put this into a superposition of two different locations. So you hit it with a light, a photon, really, which has been split into two parts. And one part hits it and moves it just a little bit, and the other part leaves it alone so that the... According to the rules of quantum mechanics, the photon has to be in two states at once, and therefore the little mirror has to be in two states at once. And what I claim is that it would stay like that for something like about a second, and then it would become one or the other. Mm-hmm. So it'd be the superposition would be unstable. And that's something that could be tested. So we'd wait and see.
And that would defy the laws of quantum mechanics as we know it.
That's right. The rules as we presently understand them would say that the superposition of the two locations of the mirror would stay forever. Mm-hmm. Unless, you, of course, it's a technically very hard experiment because you've got to worry about all sorts of little influences from the outside which might spoil it, and those can ruin the experiment. So you've got to keep this thing very isolated. You've got to hit it with the photon in a clever way so that you hit it about a million times with the same photon in order to get enough displacement.
So we'll do, so they're doing that experiment now or setting it up?
And well, they're working towards it, that's what I'd say. It'll take them a while before they get there, but that's the idea.
We'll watch for that one. You have something called twister theory, and you write in your book that in my description of twister theory, I have omitted to give the reader my statutory warning that my own views on the subject do not reflect those of the community of physicists at large. In fact, since I have devoted more than half of my lifespan to twister theory, it's hardly likely that my own perspective will correspond closely. Well, you basically say you're out on a limb on your own on twister theory. Describe for us, if you can, what it is.
I can do a bit of that. In fact, something curious has happened in the last year or so, which is it's now become actually fairly popular in certain communities. But let me say something about it. The first thing is that it's a way of looking at space and time which is different from the ordinary way. I mean, it doesn't change. You see, if you take string theory, for instance, they've been talking about having all these extra dimensions.
Right.
So space would have not just three dimensions, but it would have three with another six or seven added to that.
Right.
And in twister theory, it doesn't do that. You take the space and time with three space and one time dimension, and you construct from that another space. Roughly speaking, you think of light rays, which have got a sort of twist to them or a spin to them as well, and you represent each of those things by a single point. And so you get a new space, which has six dimensions, which you can express in a very neat mathematical way as what I would say is three complex dimensions. So each dimension is really has a real and imaginary part. The imaginary part involves the square root of minus one, so you have to understand these things. Mm-hmm. But it's the space you get is a natural, what's called a complex space. Now, it really just gives you, it's just a translation, if you like. You could take ordinary space-time, you could take twister space, and it doesn't matter which way you look at it. But if you look at it in twister space, you get a different perspective on a lot of issues to do with physics.
Would it,
and
you,
when I say...
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well,
I was going to say that...
Go ahead. Your turn.
When I say that something different has happened in the last year or so, in the book, in fact, what I say at one point is that I'm talking about twister theory and string theory, and I say that whatever it is, they can't both be right because they're mutually incompatible. And this is basically because string theory needs all these extra dimensions and twister theory depends on having exactly three space dimensions. And the irony of that is that just over a year ago, Edward Witten, who's the sort of key figure in modern developments in string theory...
The guru of string theory.
Yes, absolutely. And he has suddenly found that you can use twister space, roughly speaking. You put your strings in twister space rather than requiring to put them in extra space dimensions.
And so he's accommodated you then.
Yes, that's right. So it's all coming together. Well, at least it could be.
Well, would twister space answer those questions about uniting gravity with the other the other forces that we have such trouble with now, with that strings seem to be able to do also?
Well, it's one of the attempts at doing that. I wouldn't say any attempt is really successful yet. I mean, there are various different, and I describe these in the book, like loop variables and twister theory and string theory and Hawking's approach, and various things are described in the book. But I don't consider that really any one of them has really got there. Because one of the things I do try and say in the book is that quantum theory is going to have to be modified before we get a proper quantum gravity theory. Mm-hmm. So that none of these attempts, really, because they haven't got the right modification of quantum mechanics yet, will be a proper quantum gravity theory. But it is an attempt to bring gravity and quantum mechanics together. That's quite right. Twister theory is, that is. Yes.
Talking with Roger Penrose, author of The Road to Reality, A Complete Guide to the Laws of the Universe. I find it, it's over 1,000 pages. You're not going to read it at one sitting. And it's kind of interesting. I find it more valuable as a reference book because there's a lot of interesting stuff that you want to know how things work in the universe. Go back and he explains them in great detail or as much detail as you would like. Einstein once said that, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. It doesn't appear that way. I mean, could it be so complex that we really can't, understand it with, dark energy and things like that?
Well, we keep mentioning dark energy. I don't regard that as one of the big mysteries,
actually. Well, tell us what you think dark energy is, then.
Well, dark, I mean, it's again, it's a slightly strange thing, because Einstein, quite early on in the game, when he was trying to develop his cosmology, and he wanted to have a static universe, and he found he couldn't do that unless he introduced this extra term into his equations.
Right.
And then it was revealed, no, the universe isn't static, it's expanding. And so Einstein, you know, he kicked himself and said, if I hadn't introduced this term, I'd have predicted it was expanding. Now, the thing is, that term, once he introduced it, it didn't go away. And every respectable cosmology book mentions it. So it's not as though it's a mystery. Everybody who studied cosmology knows about this term. It's called the cosmological constant. I think what was surprising was to find that it really had a value, the sort of value it has now. So that's, it's not, the mystery is not that it's there. It just has a particular value which is just beginning to have...
Right.
Big importance in the cosmological scale.
Well, but as a mathematician, it's very easy for you as a theorist to come put a constant in an equation, but as an experimentalist to come up and figure out what the particles or whatever that is a little more difficult, is it not?
I think the big mystery is that people had tried to predict a value for the cosmological constant. This was a long time before the observations had revealed the value that it has. Presumably, I mean, there's still a little bit of controversy about it, but it's more or less accepted. But before that, people in particle physics had tried to predict a value for that number, and they came to a number which is 120 orders of magnitude wrong.
Right. You know,
so that's one with 120 zeros on it, that big a factor wrong. And so that's the mystery, if you like. If you try to get at that number from any theory we know at the moment, you just come up with a number which is just ridiculously wrong. But the fact that it's there is not so much of a mystery.
Yeah.
The what's so much of a mystery a bit more is why it has the particular value that it seems to have.
Well, but what is it physically? I mean, I hear you speaking mathematically. I'm trying to understand as a layperson, if I were to grab it, the constant, what is pushing the universe apart instead of, you know, slowing it down?
I think that's just because you're thinking about the universe in Newtonian terms.
Well, Einstein described it as geometric terms also.
Yes, no, it has a clear geometrical content. Yes, there's no problem about that.
Yeah, so
you can understand it in that way, what it means geometrically, but why it should just have such a value rather than, I mean, I don't think it's a mystery that it's there. I don't regard that as a big mystery. We just have to know, you know, why it has the value it has.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking with Roger Penrose, author of The Road to Reality, Complete Guide to the Laws of the Universe, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So what would you say is the biggest unsolved mystery of the universe then?
Well, I think we probably haven't even thought of it yet.
Yeah.
But the biggest mystery, I would say, among the things that we know about now is to do with quantum mechanics, I think.
Yeah.
The fact that quantum mechanics was, as what I said before, it doesn't make sense. I mean, the thing is that when you try to apply the rules of... Well, put it another way. Quantum mechanics has two different procedures. One is the Schrödinger equation, which tells you the evolution of a system. If you know the state at one time, it determines it completely what it does later. And there's no indeterminism there. It's just an equation which tells you how the state evolves. But then that doesn't tell you what happens when you measure something. There's a completely different procedure, which is called measurement. And you do something quite different. And that's where all the probabilities and uncertainty come in.
Mm.
Now, what's puzzling is that what's a measurement after all? I mean, you've got a measuring apparatus, and that's just a thing made up of particles and so on. So it's just another quantum system. So why doesn't that behave according to this deterministic Schrödinger equation? Yet you get these all mysterious probabilities which suddenly come in. So that's the real puzzle.
Yeah.
So it's what's called the measurement problem, or I think the measurement paradox, really. Because the measurement, if you consider your measuring apparatus as just another quantum system, you get a different answer from what you actually do when you apply quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real paradox. And it's not just that we don't understand it. It just doesn't hang together.
Do you think people are more interested in physics than we give them credit for?
I think that's true. In fact, I'm sort of gambling on that in a way, because this book is I think there are quite a lot of people out there who really would like to know a bit more about, you know, what we know about how the world works. You know, they hear pronouncements, this and that thing, and with maybe a sort of vague analogy to try and explain it, but it doesn't really explain what's going on. So this book is an attempt to, you know, get a little deeper and say, you know, this is an explanation in terms of what we know at the moment. And for this, you're going to need a little bit of mathematics, so we'll try and give you that too. So it's going a little bit beyond what you really find in most popular accounts. I'm gambling there are people out there who are interested in following that. Sorry.
I was just going to say, do you think Americans are less science, you know, interested in science than Europeans?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. No, I wouldn't say, I wouldn't know what the numbers are, but yeah. I've just been, on a book tour, and I've been given a couple of talks, and I really am amazed by how many people were there, really interested, and were asking all sorts of good questions, and really in there. So I don't see any evidence that Americans are less interested in these things than people elsewhere.
Where do you go from here after a 1,000-page book? What can you write?
I'm not doing
left?
Another like that. If I do another like that, it's divorce. I'm afraid. My wife wouldn't stand it.
Do you have something you're thinking about going?
Yes.
What direction?
There are some others. Well, they're mostly on the sort of. Well, there was one suggestion which was actually made by my Greek translators. To do something based on Escher, because Escher has these wonderful pictures which illustrate various different ideas which you can understand maybe at a deeper level what's involved mathematically. And so it would be a sort of way into certain mathematical ideas to start with the Escher and then develop these things and see where you can go. So I thought that would be quite an interesting thing to do, a much more relaxed project than this one.
Yeah. Well, we wish you good luck and have a great book tour, and we'll get back to you on your next book. Thank you for taking time to join us.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Sir Roger Penrose is Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at Oxford. His new book is The Road to Reality, A Complete Guide to the Laws of the Universe, published by Knopf. It's an incredibly interesting book if you can get through it. I hope if you get a copy, it's not going to sit on your coffee table like Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time. There's a lot of stuff in there to read. You'll find something for everybody. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Verghoff. Charles Berquist is our director and web producer. Our interns are Corey Binns and Todd Neal. And we had help today from Martin Gelman in San Francisco. If you missed any of the stuff we talk about at Science Friday, surf over to our webpage at sciencefriday.com. And also you can check out Science Friday's Kids Connection there, free curriculum material for teaching science and using Science Friday. Just click on the left side of the page to the teacher's link on sciencefriday.com. Also, you can download the back editions of Science Friday and listen to them on Real Audio. Well, we've run out of time. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.